So welcome to this episode of the Force North podcast. This week we have none less than Philippe Ombreran, the author of Scan Code. So welcome, Philippe, and perhaps an introduction of yourself.
Yeah, so my name is Philippe Ombreran. I'm both a French citizen by birth and a US citizen by adoption, which makes me for a conflicted person, because these are two very arrogant countries. And I develop open source tools mostly for open source license and origin detection. And one of my claim to fame is that I have my name attached to a commit in the Linux kernel, which is one of the largest deletion of code commands. So I'm very good at deleting code commands in code. Writing code is another question, but this deleting command I'm very good at.
One of the things we're obviously going to talk about is compliance and this stuff. So I think it's good if we all have a common ground on the compliance part. So what is compliance for you?
Well, compliance when it comes to licenses is a bit of unfortunate that every piece of software is licensed and there are copyright laws, which means that we have to abide by these terms. And compliance, just making sure that we can comply with these terms of license. Now, in the world of proprietary and commercial software, there's not two contracts which are the same. Pretty much every single software purchase has different terms, at least in the enterprise world. We've been a bit smarter in the world of free and open source software, where there's only a handful. Maybe up to thousands if you look at oddities, different licenses. And at heart, complying means, you know, providing credits to the author of the software. That's the essence of most of the open source software licenses. In some cases, providing the source code. And in a few other cases, also providing some change notification. So the gist of it about complying is ensuring you know what you have, that you credit the authors of the software that you reuse, and in some case you redistribute and notify of any changes you have made to the software.
Excellent. So, and where does Scan Code come in into this picture?
Well, in a perfect world, there wouldn't be a tool like Scan Code. And everybody would know everything about the origin license of every bit of code you use. Unfortunately, things are pretty messy out there. And Scan Code is a tool that detects the license of the code that you use. So it finds license, copyrights, and package manifest information such that you can get the information and decide and understand what you need to do to comply, basically, because otherwise it can be a bit messy. You may know that, but most of the software developers don't care too much for a license, and they would prefer that they would go away. So sometimes licensing information is a bit sketchy.
Okay. And how does it work? It obviously looks at the source code, but and uses some kind of database of known licenses, etc. But can you briefly describe how it works?
It actually also looks at the binary, by the way. But it's essentially a search engine. So similar to what you would do for Google, except the parameters are very different. Google's has like billions and billions of files that are being indexed. And the queries are very short. You're limited to 32 words at a time when you do a search on Google. Here, the index of known open source license text and mentions and tags and notices is in the range of about 20 to 30,000 different ones, some being very short, some being very large. So you can have a single word like GPL or MIT or long license like the AfroGPL, which is like 38 kilobytes. And so the index overall is in the range of a 20 to 30 megabytes. So that's not as big as Google, of course, right? The difference is the query. The query is your code, and it's not 32 words. It can be gigabytes of code at a time. So, but the principle is the same. It's about searching. Just the parameters of the search are very different.
There are other tools that does a similar thing, like we have, and we're looking at exclusively at the open source or free software tools here, like Fossology, and we have License. Speaking about being old here, I forgot the name. It's called License Check, I think.
Yeah, so License Check is a tool from Debian.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So there's many different ways you can go the problem. It's a string search problem, and you can solve it in different ways. One of the very common way, most common way, is to use regular expressions. That's the way Fossology and License Check works, for instance. So what's been done there is to manually accumulate and craft nice regular expression patterns that will try to catch common words that exist and common sentences that exist in text that would be an indication that there is a software license. And it's a bit complicated because these are handcrafted. That means you need to pick the right things. They're both subject to false positives. That means if you've not picked the right sentence in a license, you will not find that. So that's false negative, sorry. And false positive, which is you may have patterns that you've picked that may not always be for the license you wanted to detect, or they may not be for a license at all. So that's the thing. That's one approach. The other approach is to detect the distances between two texts. So say you have a source code file, it has some notice, and you're trying to find how far apart this text is from a collection of reference text. And that's the approach taken by another tool that you've probably used without even knowing it, which is called Licensee, with two E at the end. That's the tool that's used by GitHub to display a badge for a project license on a project repository. So that's a statistical approach. You're trying to find things that are close enough. The problems here are that it's difficult to deal with the fact that there may be more than one license in one file, because you don't know where to segment and how to cut if there are more than one license, a part of a license, part of the text or source code that will match to one license, another part that will match to another one. So in practice, it works only for whole license text and close similarities. Otherwise, it's really poor. There's a lot of tools in that space that use the same approach. And in terms of technique, there's something called the edit distance and Levenshtein edit distance in particular. It's trying to find how far apart two strings are. So that's a very common, the two most common techniques.
So how is scan code different?
So scan code is different because we don't use one technique, but we use several. And the key technique in the end is just a diff. And so a diff would mean that you have a text on the one end and you have another text on the other end, and you're trying to find, literally running a diff to find words that match and sequence that match, and how much of that helps you score. But you can also visually see what was matched and what wasn't. The problem with a diff is that in practice, it's very hard to compute in a runtime that would make sense and that would be practical. To give you a bit of an idea, say you have 6,000 license texts in your reference database, license texts and license notices. So that's your index. And say that each of them, so that's your index. On the query side, say you scan the Linux kernel. Linux kernel is roughly about 60,000 files. And I know that's way too much because I've scanned the Linux kernel tens and tens of, or if not hundreds of times when we were cleaning up the license of it a couple of years ago. So 60,000 files times 6,000. You're trying to do a pairwise comparison, but each file on the license side, license index size may occur, each license may be found more than once in each file. But let's say on average 10 times. You want to do 10 times 6,000 times 60,000 comparison. That's 60,000 times 60,000, that's about 36 billion. And even if you had a very fast diff, like which would run in a millisecond, that would mean you probably would need to run for about a month just to scan one kernel. And if you were to do that, so about 1,000 hours, if you were to do that on 1,000 machines, then you could do that in an hour, but the price would be prohibitive. The whole trick we have in ScanCode is trying to find ways you can eventually do a diff without having to pay either the weight of 1 month or $10,000 to do your scan. And the way we do that is by using multiple techniques. So the first technique is very simply you hash the text, but you make it in such a way that it's not dependent on formatting and white space and all that stuff. You lowercase everything, and you take a hash and you verify whether it's a whole license like that. So which is a way to find obvious simple things like a whole verbatim text of the GPL. Though, just as a side note, there's more than one text of the GPL2, for instance. At the last count, there's more than 10 different versions that were published by the Free Software Foundation. It's just a side funny note. So you hash. The second thing is you find text that may occur verbatim inside other text. And you use automaton for that. So there's a very old algorithm called AOKarasik, which dates from 1975. So that's very old by any standards in computing. It's about 45 years old, and which is a way to originally designed to find quickly words in a dictionary. And we use that to find fragments of licenses and notices that may exist as is in a text. And that's the second technique. The third technique is essentially a search engine approach where you use an inverted index, but using bit vectors for optimization, which allows to rank the things we've not detected before. From the most likely to be a license text of this or this license to the least likely. And using this ranking, then we do a pairwise diff, but only on a subset. And we don't do like billions of diff, but just the few diff that would be needed if they hadn't been caught in the previous steps.
So, I mean, I guess when there's a hash match for the whole file, then you can stop at that point, right?
Yes, that's the whole point.
But if it's not a hash match, then you basically almost have to do all the other techniques to be sure, right?
Yes. So basically, yes, but as you progress, you keep track of the portion of the text that have no matches. Which means
tricks, sort of.
Yeah. So say you take an example of a maximal mixed license notice, which you may find in your phone, whether it's an Android or an iPhone. you go to the settings, there's a legal page that lists typically hundreds of pages of open source license notices. And they're a good test bed because it's a lot of licenses, right? So it's not only about it's only about licenses, a lot of licenses, but there's also some commands at times. Eventually, you end up with regions of text that don't have anything but maybe some copyright statements, and therefore there's no thing that will be found when you do any kind of ranking with the inverted index. step, so you don't never need to do a diff.
I noticed that the output of scan code, the JSON output, is licensed. Can you explain why you do that?
Well, it's a disclaimer to ensure that folks don't rely on it as being legally valid information. There's actually, I know there are some large corporations that use that, and they really use it in some cases almost as is, and take the output as being the source of disclosure and notices they provide to other folks. So we want to make sure that they don't we don't get caught being small flies by a big hammer when these corporations may use and rely on that information. Frankly, that's something actually we're getting rid in the next releases pretty soon. It's not super helpful, and it's not a big delayer one way or the other. It's just a disclaimer that we include in the output.
Okay, but there's some kind of statement saying that I must give credit as well to scan code when using the scan code output. Am I right?
So the credits are included in the output. In that sense, yeah. It's similar to the kind of things you would have with a bison skeleton, parser skeleton, if you know about the bison lexer and parser. Mm-hmm. So it's included systematically in the output. The primary reason has been to be a legal disclaimer, but in the end, we already have a legal disclaimer in the Apache license that we use anyway. So it's a bit redundant. And as I said, that's something we're getting rid of because it's really redundant. So it doesn't bring anything special compared to the bare Apache license.
Okay. So in my work, I work mainly, I would say, with compliance issues. And what I see when I look at tools is basically two strategies or approaches to do compliance. It's the centralized like approach where you have a legal department, dedicated engineers that do all the compliance work. And then you have the decentralized where you give some response or perhaps even a lot of responsibilities to the developers, to the development teams, etc. And perhaps you call in the legal team when there's a tough case. What do you have any ideas on this?
Well, I have preferences, but mm-hmm. we don't want to suggest any preferences there. And you can go any way you want with scan code. Personally, I would prefer to actually decentralize the work. That means empower everyone that develops software and that eventually includes third-party code in their own software project to ensure that they understand what they're doing, what's the license, and run the tools to do that. But we don't promote that in any way, shape, or form, except that the tools being command line and easy to install and deploy enable that. The approach where you have a centralized, strictly centralized, everything centralized usually has a real hard time to scale. So I know several companies that do that. Usually doesn't scale very well because you end up having a dedicated function that owns the thing, and you're always in a catch-up mode with what the software developers are effectively doing in terms of reusing third-party code. And where you get the best of both worlds is when you can have developers which understand and are enabled to do their own discovery and choices about license, plus the ability for legal team to verify and ensure that there's no unknown unknowns that are and liabilities that are being acquired by software developers. And in earnest, the biggest problem actually is not so much free and open source software, but would be more when it comes from proprietary and commercial software. You have much more risks in using commercial software license-wise than you would ever have with free and open source software.
When it comes to the developers and understanding licenses, what's your experience there? Do one need to educate them, or is the tool enough to sort of highlight the issues and then they learn by reading the tool warning, so to speak?
They learn a lot, but there's a... So I think things are getting much better than it was a few years ago. Very often a few years ago, I would see software developers saying, hey, we're using software, it's free, so it's okay. And free meaning literally, I was able to download it from the internet, therefore it's free. which is still the case, but more and more folks tend to understand a bit more what free and open source software license mean. I guess where there's a lot of education that needs to be done is around copyleft license, where very often you see blanket policy saying copyleft bad. And that's not the case. I mean, copyleft license are not bad. They're essential. They're a good tool. And you can use them in a commercial and proprietary setting most of the time without any problems. Just ensure that you are complying, which in the vast majority of the cases is both straightforward, simple, and much simpler than whatever you would need to do from a commercial point of view with proprietary software.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Scancode and the other tool. Let's go into the other tools later on, but it's developed in the open. Asking why might be... So what's the strategy behind that?
Well, so business-wise, so I'm the CTO of a company called Nexbee, and we, for better or worse, I like to say, even if it sounds like big words, I mean, we're on a mission, so we're a bit mission-driven. Our mission is to ensure that everyone can use more free and open source software better, faster, and more efficiently. And eventually, if you use a lot of it, you end up with a problem of volume. And if any of you have ever used or developed using, for instance, Node, NPMs, JavaScript, it's very easy to build an application that has several hundreds, if not thousands, of dependencies. That means you have 1,000 packages, potentially thousands of authors, origins, and licenses to deal with. So it's very easy to have a lot of that. Our approach is simple business-wise. We have tools that help you uncover the origin, license of code, and more. And they're all free and open source. And we have one commercial product, which is for software teams, business teams, to help them deal with the volume of having multiple products and potentially tens of thousands of third-party origin to track with, to track and comply. So that's the reason why. And I think it's a good... good mix for us. We're also offering services, but there's no like can bet and switch or open core things that's going on. There's really tools that deal with code and tools that deals with the problems of business teams. One is commercial, one is, and the rest are free and open source.
Cool. So what's the pros? What's the benefits of doing it in the open?
Oh, the benefit of doing it in the open is very simple. First, you have many more users, and you can drive the direction in the sense that makes sense. You can also have other tools that build on that. So there are several tools that are embedding Scancode. It's used, for instance, it's used, for instance, at ORT. I know it's used in large open source foundation like the Object Web, OW2. at the Eclipse Foundation. I know that folks at the Free Software Foundation, and maybe Free Software Foundation Europe also use some of it. So being able to use that is great. We get a lot of feedback also based on that. So it helps make the tool better. It's used by OpenShift at Red Hat, I know. And we've received contributions from all places, from lawyers, which would be a bit surprising for a software tool, but it has a lot of licenses. It's about license. We have quite a few users that are themselves lawyers and that are able to contribute with what they know best, which is legal text.
Do you see any drawbacks on doing it in the open?
So that's not specific to ScanCode, but any open source project, you always have to determine how much time you want to devote to the more exotic issues or platforms. For instance, if somebody cannot run ScanCode on an older CentOS 32-bits customized to run on Amazon Web Service, is it worth for me to treat that as a bug or not? That's the kind of thing that's difficult. So odd platforms and or odd configurations sometimes, you're always tempted to fix every bug, and trying to resist not fixing every bug is the difficult thing, because my natural tendency and natural tendency of everyone when you do this kind of thing is to be helpful, and you want to have every of your users and every one of users to be helped and satisfied. And you really have sometimes folks that comes with a really odd request and or odd architecture, odd environments, and that's always difficult to say no.
Yeah.
When it comes to working in the open, how large would you say that the community is around the tool? Do you get lots of external contributions, or how does it look?
So we're getting contributions. It's hard to actually. I wouldn't know exactly because I didn't measure that. I know there's a couple hundred forks of folks out there. So that's one data point. There's over 1,000 stars, if that means anything, on GitHub. So the second data point. And we have a chat channel for ScanCode Toolkit and on other projects on Gitter, where there's about 600 or 700 people. So that's some point. In terms of contributors, I'd say we have probably over the years received contributions, serious contributions from probably roughly 20 to 30 people. And we may have up to 80 different contributors. So that would be the order of magnitude of the contributions. I assume that there's probably one contributor for every 1,000 users, roughly. So if you say 80 contributors, that's probably 80,000 users. That would be a rule of thumbs, very rough rule of thumb, based on previous projects I've managed in the past, which were probably even more successful than ScanCode.
I bet there are more users of the program Ellis than there are ScanCode. So it's a relative narrow scope. What is the difference between ScanCode.io and ScanCode?
Oh, so ScanCode.io, it's a new tool that's just emerging. Actually, it's not been much publicized or announced yet. We're working on the announcement and wrapping on some documentation. It's a tool very simply to run ScanCode on the server. So it's database backed. So as opposed to just being a tool that you run on the command line, you install it with a Postgres database, and you can run scans on the server and store scans. The difference also is that it's not only a tool to run scans, but it's also a tool to organize what I would call pipelines of code analysis. where you can have multiple steps and do complex things. One of the first example is to analyze Docker images. And so Docker images, they're eventually as complex as a full Linux installation. You have a whole user space minus the, so it's like a Linux installation minus the kernel, right? So you have eventually a lot of system package, Linux package, application packages, and custom code that ends up in these images. Furthermore, it's combined in what's called images and layers, where you may have in one of these file system slice bash that's installed, it could be removed on the next one. So you may have multiple versions of the same package, which makes things a bit complicated. And so what you want to do there is, for this kind of analysis, is ensure that you can go in multiple steps in the analysis pipeline, which is arbitrarily complicated in some case, to do not one scan, but multiple focus scans on a specific area and domain. Take another example. You may not want always to scan everything the same way. If you find that you have a majority of Java jars in a directory, maybe the techniques you will use to scan in that directory would not be just the random, well, not the random, but the base common scan that you were doing everywhere. But you may want to look very specifically at things that exist in the Maven file. You could do in the future some lookups specifically on the jars in an index of Maven jars, for instance, these kind of things. So the whole idea of the pipelines in ScanCode.io is to be able to organize smarter analysis that would not be just one scan, but multiple focus scan to determine the whole original license of the code you're dealing with.
So I guess one of the upsides with running it on a server, which is a more persistent setup, is that you can cache the results, right? So that if you have already scanned and sort of you have a result, so that you know the license of some things. Once you build on top of that, you could save yourself some work. Is that correct?
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So that's definitely so that's not implemented yet, but that's definitely part of the deal. And part of the plan is that you can capitalize that. So the way we're doing it there is that there's several initiatives that are going on. One, which is a bit of a legacy for me, which is a project called Clearly Defined that I co-founded with other folks, but it's primarily led by folks from Microsoft. And it's a project at the opensource.org organization, so incubating at the OSI, which is eventually running scans with scan code on millions of packages and then trying to review these after the fact. So you already have there about 10 million-ish scans available, except they're slightly outdated, older versions of scan code. The data are not really readily accessible and consumable by everyone. You have a not too clunky, but a bit of a clunky API, and you cannot really download everything. So we're working separately on another project that will be called, at least for now, very simply, the PackageDB, the package database, where the goal is very simply to have a database of all the package metadata plus the scan, and make this both entirely open, but also really easy for everyone to contribute to and consume and download and share. So that's one thing. And where you would have also all the scans available, but up to date scans, and with a ScanCode.io server on the back end too. Plus, the second thing is to organize campaigns with specific package ecosystems to help fix things up. So for instance, I'm discussing with the folks from Perl, to do a massive campaign of scanning for license of all the Perl packages. And we would run that with ScanCode. And then we want to apply heuristics and some simple machine learning on top of that to determine whether the scan and license information are okay and acceptable and clear. And if they're not, so we can organize a community review with the Perl community to determine where we have issues so they can be fixed and help educate and fix upstream in each of the package the license information. The goal is that if it's clean and clear, it's better for everyone. It's better for the users, but it's also better for the authors themselves. So it's similar to something I had done a couple of years ago on the Linux kernel. I was trying to clarify a bit the licensing there, but we're trying to do that potentially not for one project, albeit a large one like the kernel, but doing it for a whole ecosystem at once. So potentially Python. I mean, some areas which are a bit gray in terms of licensing today include the so Nugget, but that's a problem that Microsoft's taking care of with a clearly defined project. But Java is an area where licensing information is very scarce when you use Gradle and Java in general. It's hard to go and find correct license metadata information. So to give you an example, Python is dear to and close to what we use and dear to my heart. And so I'm working closely with the Python community there to first trying to adopt better license documentation practices for the Python package. And after that, probably trying to do some kind of massing scan campaign too at the same time.
Okay, thank you. We're running a bit out of time, so we're going for the last question here. We listened to your talk at SFSCon a couple of weeks ago, and where you talked about small size businesses and compliance. Can you describe what you talked about there?
Yeah. So the gist of it there is that very often you have a lot of commercial software companies in that space that are trying to sell you a lot of stuff, which I think is fine and jolly. In the case of small businesses, the key takeaway is that you don't need to buy commercial software for now, most likely. You can go and do most of what you need with a tiny bit of processes and a tiny bit of free and open source tools. So that's one takeaway. The other takeaway is in terms of the hierarchy of processes that you can put in place. You need to start with something very simple and avoid jumping the gun to something too complex. And the third thing is that was more on the legal side, which is really the key risk from a legal perspective when you use software today, and free and open source software, are more on the commercial and proprietary side. In particular, when you have a company that provides draw license, so they offer the same code or similar offering under a free and open source license on the one end and a commercial license on the other end, very often with a copyleft or from copyleft, that's where you want to be the most careful, because there's a strong incentive for them to ensure that you switch to a paying plan. So that was the some of the key takeaways of the presentation there.
It's kind of hard to find a good, what should I say, a good workflow documented online. And this, so for small businesses saying like, this is how you start doing compliance and this is the end result.
That's true. That's actually a bit missing today. There's an exercise and an initiative called OpenChain, but it's more geared towards the need of large companies. So it's not really adapted to smaller companies. There's There's one example of a simple policy on the site called the Bureau Council that I know of, but having a simple, small business focused document that will explain in a few pages, so that will be brief also, and not hundreds of pages, not a compendium, basically. There's no such thing at the moment, and that would be definitely something interesting to do.
Okay, so perhaps we should end this session here by putting this on our to-do list, the never-ending to-do list. Okay, on behalf of everyone, great having you here. Thanks for being here, and thank you a lot from everyone for your tools. They are providing a great resource for so many people I know, including lawyers, as you mentioned before. So 200, thanks for everything.
Well, I'm having a lot of fun with doing that, and it was really a blast to discuss with you guys. So thank you for having me.
Well, thanks for coming.
Yeah, good times. Thanks.